We know that no one can succeed alone. Since the Second World War, more than 120,000 Norwegian women and men have served shoulder to shoulder with friends and allied forces. They have participated in almost 100 missions, fighting for values on which we build our societies. A bridge of trust has been built between our brothers in arms and our allied countries. Some soldiers did not make it home, and many suffered injuries. A few have been honored as war heroes. None should be forgotten.
Welcome to another episode in Friends and Allies. We are going to talk to some of our closest allies, and this time we are going to travel a bit in time, forward and back. And to help with that, I have with me Mitch Atterback. Welcome to you, sir.
Very glad to be here. Thank you.
You're retired. You used to be, or you ended up as a lieutenant colonel.
That's correct. I'm retired from the U.S. Army Special Forces, but I started as a private. I started as a young man and a college dropout. After 3 years of college in the United States, wasting my own money and time, I had a conversation with my father, and I said, "Dad, I just don't feel like I want to keep doing this." And he gave me the best fatherly advice he ever did. He said, "Well, there's always the service." So I went to the Army recruiter the next day and said, "Can I enlist with a guarantee of going into the Special Forces training?" And the recruiter said, "Yes." So I signed 22 pages of documents and raised my hand and swore an oath and enlisted in the Army. And that evening at the fraternity house, at dinner, everybody asked, "What did you do today? What did you do today?" And I said, "Well, I enlisted in the Army. I'm dropping out at the end of the semester, and I'm going into Army Special Forces training." And that's how I got started.
And everybody was cheering?
Half of the fraternity brothers were excited. The other half were confused and maybe disappointed.
How did you cope with the training? Because it's nothing that you just walk in the street from and become a Special Forces soldier. You have to go through a multiple level of exercises.
Well, you certainly have to enlist in the Army and go through infantry training, which was 4 months, and then parachute training, 3 weeks. And then the opportunity to be at Fort Bragg to start the Special Forces training either within a week or after a few months of train up. And I opted to start within a week. I wanted to get into it and see how it would go. I realized I was probably the right kind of young man to go into that training, having lived an outdoor life and being physical and enjoying difficult challenges. And I was 21 years old, not the youngest person in the class. And fortunately, I was successful.
Unfortunately, because then you have to do service.
Yes. So I spent 6 years on active duty and as a staff sergeant, left active duty to go to college to finish a degree and go through officer training, and became an officer after a couple of years.
And during all your time in service, you also did multiple deployments abroad. For instance, you told me before we started that you had been in the former East Germany, in East Berlin.
Yes, from 1956 until 1990, the United States had a now declassified, it was classified at the time, a special forces unit stationed in West Berlin in the American sector that didn't wear uniforms and had non-standard haircuts that were there to be prepared to conduct operations in what would become behind enemy lines. So I was fortunate to be a young man stationed there as a radio operator. And that was, I would guess, that counts as my first overseas deployment. It certainly does on my military records that was an overseas deployment, West Berlin.
How was it to be in Europe and also in West Berlin during the Cold War from your point of view?
Well, it was a fascinating time. President Reagan was our president. Bruce Springsteen, Born in the USA, was a popular song. This is where I first came in contact with Norwegians. There were a lot of Norwegian people living in West Berlin. Some of them were au pairs, some of them were tutors. And that's where I first got to know the wonderful people that I realized, hey, I like these folks. I think I have a lot in common with them. I'll have to spend more time with them in the future. And here we are.
And here we are. But before you ended up here, you also had deployments in the Far East.
Yes, I was watching on television when the planes struck the Twin Towers in New York, and was serving in the National Guard. Unfortunately, we were attacked, but fortunately, the Special Forces were some of the first to be called upon. I, as being a National Guard soldier in the Special Forces, didn't go immediately, but by the summer of 2002, as a captain commanding a Special Forces team, we deployed to Afghanistan, initially to Kabul, and then onward to the Helmand province, where at the time, there were only 20 Americans in all of Helmand province. And I tell people that have been to Helmand, and it's hard for them to imagine a time when there were only 20 Americans in the entire province. And that was in very late 2002.
And your objective at the time was to hunt down insurgents?
Well, I would say at that time we had won. The Taliban had put their rifles away. There was not much fighting, although people were still dying. We were there to have a presence in the Helmand, and then we were called back to Kabul to train a battalion or a Khandaq of the Afghan National Army. That was a successful deployment, and I brought all my guys and myself back home safely, and we consider that a major success. Having left Afghanistan a little better than we found it by having trained about 500 of their soldiers. That wasn't the only deployment. I've had two other trips to Afghanistan in uniform and also a trip to Iraq in uniform in government service.
How did you find the difference between Afghanistan and Iraq? Was it totally different or some similarities as well?
Well, as a serving member of the military, you can always find similarities in that you're with your fellow soldiers. You're eating army food. You got there on a C-17. You carry the same weapons and equipment. However, the differences pretty much end there. Well, I should say the comradeship with your Afghan and your Iraqi partners is very similar. You're always going to become brothers with those with whom you're working. But I did find the work in Iraq was quite important at the time. I was there at what was called the Surge in 2007, 2008, and there was a lot happening in Iraq at that time. And I was able to develop relationships that allowed me many years later, 8 or 9 years later, to return to Iraq as a civilian during the fight against ISIS in Mosul to work on my master's thesis in journalism. During Christmas break in 2016-17, I flew from Denver, Colorado to Erbil and then onward to Mosul to join the same Iraqis that I had advised 8 or 9 years ago and rode with them in their Humvees as they fought ISIS. And I shot video and documented it for my master's thesis in journalism.
That must be a bit of a transition. I mean, from being a fighting soldier or operator to see how it ended.
Well, that's a great question. I was very pleased to see when I was in Mosul in early 2017, there were no American advisors there at the time, close by. Iraqis were doing it all on their own. They were doing things in Mosul that I saw eight years ago, they would have been asking me to help them do or asking me to do it for them. But they were incredibly advanced for what was being asked of them. They were liberating their second largest city from some of the greatest evil the world had seen in 75 years. And they were doing it all on their own, flying their jets, flying their helicopters, dropping their bombs, doing their own medevac, repairing their own vehicles under enemy fire, bringing hot food to the troops when two houses down, guys are throwing hand grenades in the rooms because ISIS is in there. But two houses down the street, there is beans and rice being served warm. Very, very advanced. And also observing human rights and conducting humanitarian operations at the end of each day, all on their own. I was very impressed.
Must have been satisfying for you to witness.
Completely satisfying. And also it allowed me to realize that perhaps people can find some comfort in the knowledge that this military, this country that we invaded in 2003, their military has come a long way, and their military and the men in, and women in it are doing a great job. And we deserve some credit for helping them get to that point.
You didn't spend all your time in service abroad. You also stayed home or conducted your duty in the U.S.
That's right. I served after 9/11. I realized, I think I'm going to keep doing this. This is now my calling. The country's been attacked. There's a great need for people with my skills to return to military service, so I did. In between deployments to Iraq or Afghanistan, I had various deployments or jobs in the States. In Southern California, I was stationed, and for almost four years, I commanded a unit that was stationed along the border, assisting the U.S. Border Patrol and the Coast Guard, interdicting drug smugglers coming up from Mexico. So I commanded a counter-drug task force unit on the border with Mexico. Men and women, National Guard of California, both air and army. And it was a great job. We were doing important work, trying to stop the flow of illegal drugs, working with agencies that are quite busy right now also. So that was quite satisfying. And while stationed in Colorado, I was deeply involved in military disaster response for several years. And that's probably one of my most satisfying periods of duty in the States, is to be Colorado's point person when it came to advising civilian authorities on the use of the military for natural disaster response. And we had floods and fires in Colorado, and I was one of the first people there, certainly in uniform, to give the county sheriff and the local officials the best advice on what military was available and how they could use it.
Did you have any specific incident that you are bringing with you?
Yes, there was a moment that when I'm asked what's one of your most memorable opportunities in the military, it's surprising, and maybe the listeners will find this surprising too. It happened in Colorado. In September of 2013, there was a terrible flood in the county of Boulder. An amount of rain fell that has never fallen before within 24 hours. And I think in some measurements, it was half a meter of rain in 24 hours. Boulder is a somewhat mountainous county. Terrible flooding. 3,000 people trapped and needing rescue. Many of them with their pets. I had fortunately done a master's degree in San Diego in Homeland Security. I chose to study the use of the military in disaster response and wrote two papers on rescuing pets during natural disasters. I considered myself one of the self-proclaimed subject matter experts in the United States on how the military can rescue pets. And there was indeed a law signed by President Bush that mandated the rescue of pets. If your government accepts money from the federal government, you must have a plan to rescue pets. So at that point, when I was called to the command post for the flood response, I gave the order that all pets will also be rescued. They will go on the helicopters. They will go on the trucks. I spoke to the helicopter pilots who were not in my command and said, you all are okay with taking pets on your helicopters, aren't you? And they said, yes, sir, we love animals. So when I answer this question, I say, I'm the person that gave the order to rescue the pets during the Boulder flood, put them on the helicopters, put them on the trucks, and over 1,000 pets were rescued by helicopter during that period. And it was, to that point in history, the largest aerial evacuation of pets in the United States. And I'm quite proud of that.
And you should be, rightly so. We're gonna take a leap in time now, because you are deeply interested in history and in military history, and that's one of the reasons that we are making this episode here in Norway, in Trondheim, because you are soon to attend almost an reenactment, or at least a visit to one of the more famous sites for the Americans to be involved in the Second World War, the Operation Rype.
That's right.
That's one of your main thing these days.
It is. I retired from the military in 2015. I have, since that time, chosen to continue to find ways to have meaning in my life, continue to serve others, and honor the memory of those that served before me. I didn't have a lot of time while in uniform to study the history of my organization. I was busy, as you've heard, doing things on the border with floods and in Iraq and Afghanistan and Berlin. But since retirement, I've made myself study the history of special operations, mostly in World War II. As a very young man, I watched the 1965 Kirk Douglas movie, The Heroes of Telemark. So I've always been aware of that movie and those men who conducted the heavy water sabotage. 2 years ago, I participated in an expedition with a Scottish adventure travel company called SOE Expeditions, and we skied from Vemork across the Hardangervidda to the crossing point in Sweden. And then I learned that this organization was going to sponsor an Operation Rype commemoration on the 80th anniversary. And I told Matt Smith, the owner of SOE Expeditions, well, Matt, that's an American operation. You need me involved as one of the planners, and I'd be happy to help guide it, to which he happily agreed. And that is why I'm here, to just in a few days, I'll be receiving my American teammates, and everyone coming is from the States. And we will be arriving in Trondheim, and we'll be transporting up to Jefshon, where we will spend several days at the farm, and we will, hopefully, if the snow permits, be skiing to some of the same railroad sabotage targets that the men of the Office of Strategic Services attacked in the spring of 1945.
Because the Operation Rype and that endeavor was conducted by American soldiers, because most of the other sabotage actions in Norway during the Second World War were initiated by the Brits.
Certainly initiated, but mostly carried out by men of Norwegian Independent Company Number 1, known after their commander was killed informally as Company Linge. So there was quite a bit of railroad sabotage happening in Trøndelag in late 1944, early 1945, conducted by Company Linge men, trained by the Brits. And one of those operations, Woodlark, Operation Woodlark, destroyed the Jørstad Bridge in January of 45. Some of those men joined Operation Rype. So not just the Americans of the Office of Strategic Services led by Major William Colby were involved in Rype, but up to 10 Norwegians were also attached formally or informally. Some of them military men, some of them just locals who had great skiing ability and knew the land and wanted to help hurt the German retreat from Norway, because the purpose of Operation Rype and all of the railroad sabotage in late 44, early 45 was meant to keep the Germans in Norway. And some people find that hard to understand. Why would you want to keep the enemy here in Norway? Well, because the Germans were trying to reinforce the defense of Germany, extend the fight in the fatherland, and extend the fight in Europe, in Western Europe. So to keep upwards of 350,000 German troops stuck here would have, and did, potentially shorten the war down there in Germany.
We're not going to go in depth of the operations because we don't have the time, but when listening to you, I realized that the very close relationships and our allied forces combined go all the way back to the Second World War and have been very close in the years after. And you have to, I'm sure you acknowledge that.
Certainly I do. The state of Minnesota has had a military partnership with Norway for over 50 years now. The exchange between Norway and Minnesota National Guard has been happening for a very long time. It happens every year. The Marines have been coming here to train for a very long time, and the Special Forces as well. And this has continued and will continue. I'm just grateful to be, I would be considered a veteran and a civilian now, but I am bringing people here to continue the partnership, continue the current partnership and extend it, and also to honor our mutual history, the mutual history of fighting here to liberate Norway during the war.
How important is that to not only talk about all this this history, but also to be there physically and almost reenact what happened?
Well, I tell you, it's great to read a book or see a movie or go to a cemetery and read somebody's tombstone. But to follow in the ski tracks of those men is I believe a deeper way to honor their service and sacrifice. And we're not just honoring the Americans of the OSS, from which the Army Special Forces and the CIA trace their heritage, but we are also honoring the brave Norwegians in their 20s and 30s that risked everything for king and country. And it's very powerful to be a part of something that I consider very important, and thanks to you, more people are learning about the importance of it.
If you go back to the 21-year-old school dropout who enlisted, and you look at your service since then, would you do it again?
I would. I would do it again, and I wouldn't go to college first. I would enlist immediately, probably not for the Special Forces, maybe for the Rangers. Some place to toughen me up, to give me some skills, but I certainly would have followed the path of military service after high school.
So wearing the Green Beret is not ultimate at all, is it?
Well, I can't, nothing, who's to say what is the ultimate in life, but I certainly would have gone to the Special Forces again after getting maybe 4 years of experience in the Rangers, yes.
Is it something that you wish you hadn't done during all this, all of your service years?
Well, there certainly is, but you only think about things you wish you hadn't done when you're unhappy or depressed. And I try never to be either of those. So it's easy. Well, I can't say it's easy. We must discipline our minds and our hearts to not think about the regrets, because there's so much other things to be accomplished in life. And thinking about your regrets is like dragging an anchor behind you. So I choose not to acknowledge any of those regrets and just live in a state of gratitude.
So, as we stated, you are out of the service now. You're a civilian, but you're still bringing the service and the military with you, and your status as a veteran is sort of strengthened that. How do you find that status, that phrase veteran? How does that apply or should apply to veterans all around?
The status of being a veteran is both an honor and a continued responsibility. Just because we've received our discharge papers and can now wear a nice pullover that says veteran or have a baseball hat that says veteran, it doesn't mean that we have lost our ability to connect to a cause greater than ourselves or find other ways to serve. So I encourage veterans that I come in contact with, and I've learned here in Norway, many of my veteran friends feel the same way. And what we have to do as veterans is remember, we weren't just young people in uniform doing what we had to do. We were serving a good cause. We were serving with people of like mind for the opportunity to do something good in the world. And I encourage veterans to remember that. And it's not just about, I miss my bros. I want to hang out with my bros because I miss my bros. It is, you were doing something good and meaningful. And there's a lot of work to be done as a vet to help. Whether that's helping animals or helping people, it's not hard to look around. And it can be some of the most humbling, simple things. And I'll give some examples. I worked at a goat farm when I got out of the Army as a volunteer to do humble things, taking care of animals that needed help. And that was a great recalibration to take yourself down to one of the most basic levels of service. I wasn't even serving humans. I was serving animals. And I found that very rewarding, peaceful, relaxing. And that allowed me to think about what other ways will I serve? And then I found serving in the natural disaster response community, again, very rewarding. I took the classes offered by the government and found a county to sponsor me. And now, throughout the summers, typically I work on wildfires, not as a firefighter, but as part of the command team that manages the response to fires. And just like a military deployment, I go to a place that's in crisis. I'm there with a like-minded team of individuals, high-functioning, patriotic, motivated people that want to do good. And we work hard. And for 2 or 3 weeks, we do the best we can. And we leave the place better than we found it. I find that rewarding. So I ask veterans, find other groups that are doing meaningful work, whether it's paid or volunteer, and join them. And you will find that not just the work that you're doing with your own mind and hands, but to be shoulder to shoulder with other people doing the same thing will fill you with a sense of accomplishment, satisfaction, and you'll remember, yeah, this is how it felt. This is great. I remember this. And guess what? We're not getting shot or blown up this time either. And everybody's happy that we're here. I want veterans listening to just reflect and think about what I just said. Remember why you were in, and there are lots of ways out there to find and connect. And we're sitting in a building dedicated to that very cause. I'm sitting here in the Veteranhuset Midt-Norge, thanks to my buddy Arnstein. I have to tell you, folks, once you're a veteran, you have an international veteran card, whether you believe it or not. The fact that you served in any country you go to makes you part of a group that is just waiting to meet you. And I met my friends here at the Vet House in November when I was here doing prep for our mission that starts next week. And in I would almost say typical fashion, the vets opened up their house literally and figuratively and said, "Hey man, you're a vet. What can we do for you? What do you need?" And particularly my Norwegian veteran friends are exactly cut from the same cloth as are my American veteran friends. I would have to say I haven't seen a better clubhouse anywhere in the States than this, but I'm staying here at their hospitality, doing what I can to show here in Norway that Norway really respects veterans. Every country could do more for their veterans, Norway included, the U.S. included. When it comes man to woman to man, person to person, vets really take care of vets. And Norwegian vets especially are great at taking care of their international veteran friends.
And I'm so happy to have you participating in this and visit us here at Veteraners Midt-Norge. And I'm looking very forward to see the results of your expedition to Jefsjøen. And I hopefully will have a report, or people can find it somewhere on the internet in the months to come.
Thank you. I'm Mitch Utterback on social media, and I'll be posting about our trip and certainly the results, and then putting together a presentation afterward, and look forward to returning and maybe giving that presentation to some Norwegian groups right back here.
So I was thinking, do you have any final overall thoughts about your present here in Norway, and thoughts about all the history that's been stored in Europe for your part?
As an American, I am particularly grateful for the sacrifice that Norway has made over the many years. What a wonderful country that it exists now. I'm grateful to be participating in something that honors Norway's long sacrifice over 5 years during the Second World War, and bringing other Americans here to show them this country and what you have gone through as a nation, with the hope that the relationships that they will build will be as satisfying as mine, and we will continue long into the future and make many more new friends.
In Friends and Allies, we hear the stories of some of our closest supporters, reliving with them some of their most intense moments. Et oblique, and Evette.